Well, welcome back to another episode of Questions of Faith in this Year of Faith with our very own official from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Monsignor John Kennedy.
It's great to be back, Eimear. Thank you.
Lovely to have you back. And today we are looking at a question sent in by a listener to the Vatican Radio English Section Facebook page from Ho Young Benjamin, one who asks, how does God measure success? That's so pertinent to today's world. He asks, since not many people own many resources like capital, what is a good measure of success? And how do we know what tasks God wants us to fulfill? There's so many and so much to be asked in that. So perhaps let's start at the beginning of that question. How do we measure success?
Well, Benjamin, absolutely super question. Success is a word that we use all the time. I looked it up in the dictionary before I came in today, and it says that success is the accomplishment of an aim or a purpose. So an example might be passing an exam, getting a job, winning the first 100 metres race of your life, or if you're very young, learning to ride a bicycle. And even at a cursory glance, you can see that success is always going to be something very personal. It's very different then for each individual. In the dictionary, there was another definition of success, which was more worldly, I thought. And it says that it is the attainment of popularity or profit. And it's true that you can measure success by how well known you are or how much money you have in the bank. We've all heard of successful businessmen, businesswomen who are heading up huge companies and their profits are going through the roof and so on. And they become a little bit like film stars. They become famous. And then the question you might ask yourself is, well, how much success is enough success? But what Benjamin is asking here is this the kind of stuff that God's interested in? And I think if I wanted to give Benjamin a quick answer, I'd say no. Material things really mean very little to God. God wants us to think about much higher things like faith and hope and love. He wants us to focus on keeping the commandments, loving God and loving our neighbour. In other words, God wants our love and not our trophies. And he wants our heart and soul. And he's not really bothered about the medals and the certificates. So let's go back to the whole idea for a moment of worldly success. We know that success happens all the time. Sometimes it happens very quickly and unexpectedly. But success in worldly terms is rarely permanent. In fact, it can be quite fleeting. Thinking back a couple of years ago to a runner who was able to do 100 metres in 10 seconds. And that was quite a world record. Great success. Now, in fact, the world record is something around 9 seconds. And you probably can't even remember who ran it in 10. So as Christians, you will, of course, admire success, but you'll also know that it won't last. It's fleeting, it's earthly, it's transient. And we, as Christians, are all looking for more permanent realities. The other problem with worldly standards is that there's really only room for one winner. Whoever comes second or third last, really don't get any of the limelight. Whereas God, on the other hand, is eternal. God never forgets. For all things, God is present, and he's not the God of the winners. He's the God of everyone. And so you can understand that his values are different. He's so different to ours. And so therefore, when we're in communion with him, he's asking us to reflect on what he considers to be important. And then once we grasp that, to almost like transform our lives so that our own lives can be like his, and that we'd no longer conform ourselves to the standards of the world. That's why St. Paul says, set your hearts on the higher gifts, on the things that come from your Maker in heaven. And doing this then molds us in a way to see God, see the world as God asks us to do it, and to reshape our lives according to his life too. In this way, we put all people first, not just those who come first. And we don't forget about the poor and the marginalised and all those people who are forgotten in the world. And I suppose maybe to conclude our question on this, Pope Francis said recently, in a world where there's so much wealth, so many resources to feed people, it's unfathomable that there are so many hungry children, that there are so many children without an education, so many poor persons. Poverty today is a cry. We all have to think, if we could become a little poorer, all of us then have to do this. We'll be right back.
We're continuing with this question that was sent in to us by Benjamin, a young listener and reader of ours and follower of ours on our English section Facebook page. He asked us how we measure success. Last episode, we looked at how we humans measure success. And you said this is not how God wishes us to consider a success. So the question obviously follows, how does God measure success?
Oh, yes. How do I measure success? How long is a piece of string? Sometimes an example might help to give us an answer. I was standing near the Vatican about 2 years ago when the Rome Marathon was taking place. I love taking photographs, and so I brought my camera with me and I stood at the point which is about the 17 kilometres, about a third way through the entire length of the course. And of course, first come through are these elite runners. We've all seen them on television, these great athletes. You know, they're slim and they're tall and they're sleek and they're fast, and they make running look effortless. Then next came a group, all people with disabilities. They were using adapted wheelchairs, and some of them were even using their hands to launch themselves forward, and others were using very low wheelchairs with large wheels and sometimes even sticks as well. And then the third group that came was a larger group, all men, a throng of men and women, all ages, young and old, all shapes and sizes, all nations too. And many of them were actually sporting sponsorship badges on their on the running gear, indicating that they were running to raise funds for a particular beloved charity. I saw teenagers, I saw men and women over the age of 70, you know, supporting things like cancer charities, homeless relief projects, orphanages, and drought and famine stricken countries. So we go back now to the question of how do you measure success? Well, take this context. Which runner would you say was successful out of those three groups? Of course, each and every one of those was a great success. Each and everyone was using his or her God-given talents, and some actually for the benefit of others, some for the benefit of sport. But you ask yourself, what measurement do you want to use to decide who is the best? And I often hear commentators naming the person who wins the marathon. And I always thought, that's a bit perplexing. I mean, isn't the idea actually to take part in the marathon rather than just to win a race? And so when I hear people just naming the top three and then forgetting about the 15,000 who came behind, it often leaves me feeling a bit sorry for people who completed it in 4 hours instead of 2 hours and 20 minutes and so on. Because for each of those people, that has been a personal triumph. That has been a family celebration. That's been a source also of practical help for charities who will continue then to benefit long after the streets have been swept and transformed back in from the marathon circuit back to regular streets again. And so here, I think, we touch on an element of Christian success. So much what the world expects of us is upfront, visible, almost like in your face kind of success. But what God wants from us is all that stuff that's done in secret. See, God doesn't look at exteriors. He looks at the heart. He's not really impressed by people who do things for show or people who are proud of their own success and, you know, as if it all came from them and almost to the exclusion of other people too. Look at the gospel for Ash Wednesday if you really want to know what I mean. That's where it's you know, God asks us to pray and to fast and to give up things for Lent and to do it silently and quietly. And there's another beautiful text in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 18 where Jesus says, two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up, you can almost imagine him at the front of the temple, and he prays about himself. He says, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. And then at the back of the temple, you've got the tax collector who stands at a distance, both from him and from God. And he won't even look up to heaven, but he beats his breast and he says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus says, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone, and this is the key, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.
How does the world measure success?
Last weekend, I was passing by a store in Rome where there was some sort of celebration taking place. The street outside was completely full of people and there was a lot of loud music being played. Everyone was dressed in very fine, elegant clothes and they were drinking and talking loudly. Lots of young people there too as well. And I could sort of grasp from it that some sort of success or achievement was being celebrated. I think it was actually a launch of a new store. And the usual way we actually mark achievement is to do it in this way. We go out to eat, we go out to drink, we celebrate, we get together. But in fact, the church does things so completely differently. The two big feasts in the church's calendar year are Christmas and Easter. And we see how God's values in terms of success are completely turned upside down on their head. Let's start with Christmas. Christ was born poor and in a stable. No big party there for him. And if you fast forward to Easter, Christ is almost naked on the cross and left to die on a cross outside the city, with everybody having abandoned him as well. He was even buried in a borrowed grave. So what seems foolish and a scandal to the world is in fact what God chooses as his primary option. He turns the values of the world on their heads. And this can actually make us pretty uncomfortable. We'd rather things to be done in a more familiar way. But in fact, God actually always surprises us. And then he asks us to recalibrate our standards too. And if you look in the book of Isaiah in chapter 55, you get a synopsis of what this is all about. Isaiah says, speaking the word of the God of the Lord, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts higher than yours." So what's logical, what's predictable, and what's expected is not what God does. God, in fact, doesn't think or reason as we do. In fact, on the contrary, God always calls us right out of our comfort zones. He's constantly inviting us, urging us to go beyond. In the gospel you have, if someone asks you to walk 1 mile, walk two with them. And then he says to the apostles, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, forgive 70 times seven. You know, it's almost so radical, it's unbelievable. Sell your riches and give them to the poor, and then come and follow me, he says to the young man. Then he challenges us to look at the values of the world and to follow him in our own way too. In other words, he gives us a new currency. The new currency is love. So you might say, well, why does he do this? Well, Jesus wants us to realise that as his followers, we're living in the world, in the material world, but our focus should be on the world to come, because our real home is in heaven, not here on earth. Everything on earth here is passing away. And this teaching of Jesus has been around now for 2,000 years, and it's really been accepted and brought on board by the Christian community right from its very beginning. If you look to the Christian community and see how they were from the very start, they created a community together. They shared everything that they had in common, which was again counter to the world's standards. And you can read more about this in chapter 2 of the Acts of the Apostles, where it says all the believers were together and they'd everything in common. Read more in that chapter when you'll see. And in this context, I think you can also go back to the gospel in Matthew chapter 4, where in fact the devil tried to change Jesus from his way of thinking. He tried to steer him on a different course. He brought him up to the top of a high mountain and he says, look, all of this I give you if you'll bow down and worship me. But then Jesus says, away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So really, when it comes to life and it comes to faith, we remember that we have a key, and the key is God. This key, God, must come first. And when we put that key into the lock and we turn that lock, then everything else opens up for us. Everything else fits into place, because being wrapped up in what other people think about you and being sort of moving your life along according to what other people tell you, in fact, actually can have an effect of pushing God outside of our life. And when we do this, we've slowly begun to get choked, and the true life of God becomes strangled almost within us. But God wants us to have this true life. He wants us to have indeed the fullness of life. And the last thing I'd say is that often people think that when they come close to God, when they deepen their relationship with God and have a profound rapport with him, in fact, then they have no time for other people. That's a worry that a lot of people have. But in fact, the opposite, paradoxically, is true. We find that, in fact, enriching our lives with God then has a beautiful impact, because it enriches our relationship with other people too.
I thought we'd also look at the fact of how the pressure to be successful, or what is considered successful in the eyes of the world, can often lead people to confuse success with happiness. And as a result, can often lead particularly young people faced with the pressures of today's world to be successful in the material sense, to feel that they are lacking somewhat in things. And how faith, our faith, by refocusing our vision on what success really is, can help us in this way.
It's so true. And in this world, it's very easy to get confused between success and happiness. A lot of people presume that if you're successful, you're happy. But, you know, successful people, really successful people, are very often extremely hardworking people, and they tend to work impossibly long hours. They travel from airport to airport. They're on the road all the time. They have pressures of meetings. They're always carrying their phone. They're always checking their emails and their messages and their tweets and so on. And they focus a lot on their own work and on their careers and on their business. And as a result, a lot of things can fall by the wayside. You know, it can be very hard to keep up with your friends. It can be very hard to find time for your family, to look after your children and give your children as much time and devotion and energy as they need. So there are always casualties, I would say, to great success as well. For the Christian, God is always calling us to a harmony of life, to a balance. There's nothing wrong with using your talents. There's nothing wrong with actually being successful. It's really about where your heart really is, because the Christian really understands that true happiness is only to be found in God alone. Anything else that we create, anything that we own, anything that we store away for the rainy day, those things don't really give us our profound happiness, because they don't touch our soul. They don't touch our heart. Right, money might line your pockets and you might be able to build as many houses as you can live in a year, but the true happiness, the stuff that lifts our spirits and actually draws us upwards to a communion of life in God and gives us a profound sense of satisfaction, it's really only God that can give us those things. The other things are instruments. They're helps along the way. And recently I spoke to an economist who told me that there's a new shift in how some Catholics are beginning to see the whole world of business. I suppose in part it came after this economic crash that we've had in recent years as well, which of course continues to affect many different countries around the world. But the Catholic economists are having a more realistic understanding, a more holistic understanding of how business is done. And they've come up with the theory that we have to have an economics of enough. The idea that sufficiency is enough to actually, it's not about amassing large amounts of money. You see, the world is always saying more is more. And this becomes a reflection of how great you are and how successful you are and so on. But we actually forget that we really need relatively little to live on. And sometimes it's important to actually say, I have enough. And so if you really want more money, that means that somebody else is going to have less money. And it means that you have less, you have more, while the other people actually mightn't even have enough to spend to live their basic life too. So if what motivates you is just money and gathering and amassing and so on, then you have to say, am I really fulfilling my obligation to God, and am I really trying to be a material person or a spiritual person? Because in the material, you'll find that the more you want, the more you will in fact want in the future. Whereas the spiritual offers you the chance to put everything in focus, and it realizes that you do have possessions in the world, but you also have God, who's the source of all riches and wealth. And in fact, he's the one who gives you life in eternity.
So we could say that a sign of true success is realizing that money is never really going to make you happy. It's only a tool, a means to an end. It's not an end in itself.
It's true. And money can actually facilitate you doing great works. Nothing wrong with the person having millions and millions of euro or dollars or whatever it is. But the Christian calling is to use that money for the benefit of other people.
Benjamin, really focused our attention on the concept of success in today's society. It's something Pope Francis is coming back to again and again in almost all of his public discourses. When is enough enough? Do we as Christians realize that true success is found only in poverty and praise of God, and putting our resources, our wealth as people who have to work for those who do not. So today we want to actually look at the fruits of success, how we as Christians are called by our faith to use the fruits of our success for the better of others.
There's a famous saint in the life of the church called Saint Irenaeus. You can look him up on the internet and you'll find his writings too. Saint Irenaeus says that the glory of God is man fully alive. So the person who you see to be so brimming over with life and faith and talent is the person who knows his place, knows her place as being created by God, having been given talents and opportunities, and then is able to use those and develop those talents for the glory of God and for the benefit of other people too. This is the growing sort of understanding of Christian success, to use what I have to make other people's lives more joyful, easier, more pleasant. I remember being at a wedding last year, a wedding of a Welsh girl and an English man, and they had worked in Dubai for a while. In fact, that's where they met, and they had come to meet an awful lot of people from all over the world who were living in it's a business hub, as you know, and a lot of economic activity going on there. One of their guests was the man's boss, Daniel's boss, and he is a Muslim businessman from Pakistan. He was there with his wife. I thought it was a lovely gesture for him to come to a Catholic wedding as well. But during the cocktail hour, which was very, very nice, but he told me recently how businessmen all over the world have come to the realization that you can't just go in business and make the big killing anymore when you're undertaking a project. In the past, the idea with a lot of people was to, you know, get in there, set up the shop, make a quick killing, make as much profit, and very often clear out with no concept in terms of the long-term impact, in terms of the job, the economy, the environment, all the kind of stuff. And in a sense, the goal now is much more ethical, he was telling me, that people are much more convinced, more and more, that the profit-only option is no longer a valid option. And it's not really sustainable anymore either, with low interest rates and with low growth, that really we have to have a much better, more holistic approach. He said, what we need is reinvestment. We need sustainability. This means that a larger proportion of the profits in any business activity must then be shared primarily with the workers in order to ensure them a dignity, a fair wage, and give them the possibility then of raising and educating their family, giving them a decent lifestyle, sharing the good, promoting maybe in many ways the common good. And then money must be reinvested back into the community and also to the environment, so that business then can be stable and sustainable over many generations. And in many ways, what he was saying was, you have a lot of key elements here. You've got, for success in worldly terms, it's all about education. It's all about safeguarding, being stewards of the environment. So often we know that Pope Benedict was speaking about this, Pope Francis too, so that the whole future can exist then for the future. And then in many ways, it can help people to continue to develop and continue to grow with further jobs and industry flourishing out of what has already been laid as a stable foundation as well. I think this man is quite a pioneer in terms of this approach. But as we all know, it only takes a small rudder to steer the course of even the largest ship.
And in fact, speaking of this metaphor that you give us so beautifully to end this entire series on the idea of success, our concept of success today in the world, our concept of success as Christians, our calling as Christians who are successful to put the fruits of our success at work for the benefit of all. Perhaps a suggestion we could make to Benjamin and to all of our listeners and viewers is that if they want to know a little bit more about how we can put our successes, our talents, to work in God's vineyard, if we want. And perhaps a good suggestion would be to read Caritas in Veritate, which of course is the great social encyclical written by Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who very simply defines what we or how we should measure success as Christians and how we should put it into practice for all.
It's true. And even looking up in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the whole idea of the common good, and even maybe reading the scriptures and seeing how the Lord is always calling not just individuals, but he's calling the entire community. And we think back to the Old Testament too, where God refers to the people of Israel as his people, not his individuals. So God always calling us to this community mentality that we're all together, the family of God, brothers and sisters of each other.
Thank you very much, Monsignor John Kennedy, for your insights into how we should approach the subject of success in today's world. It's a world of pressure for many of us, but it's not without its good points and rays of hope, as they say. We invite our listeners to send us to keep these questions coming in. We enjoy the challenge of answering them. They can do so by writing to us, private message at Vatican Radio's English section Facebook page, or by sending in an email. That's English@vatiradio.va. Thank you very much, Monsignor John Kennedy.
Thanks, Seymour. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.